$19 million in counting. And so that's how much they spent in this race. Mostly far-right funded super PACs against the interests of the people of St. Louis, the people of Missouri's first. They sought to divide us.
I'm Scott Baba for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today the show features the political practices of Jamil Abdullah Alamin. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wisdom Tally. The music in the background is Fight the Power, Parts 1 and 2 by the Isley Brothers. As we commemorate Black August this month, the show features a recent conversation with Aaron Kundanani, a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. The conversation with African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope explores the political praxis of Jamil Alamin. The evolution of H. Rob Brown into Jamil Alamin provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black Liberation Movement in more ways than we can account for. Here is the conversation.
Articulated the sentiments of Black people was because SNCC had a public forum, not because I articulated the sentiments better than the brothers on the streets or brothers who didn't have that public forum. I don't think that you could articulate the sentiments of Black people last year any better than they did in Detroit. So I think the movement is a leaderless movement, whereas we might influence people. We do not control people.
Well, how does this solidarity come about if there is no specific leader?
I think eventually there will. I think as the struggle progresses, you see, revolution does not occur in one stage. It's an evolutionary process, you know, like people go through different things. The masses of people become involved, then leaders are chosen. Right now, you have a vanguard struggle that's occurring, whereby groups are fighting about discussing political ideologies, which are relevant, which should be incorporated into the struggle or will be incorporated into the struggle. That's not to be misinterpreted with, you know, like the revolution, because it's just a phase of evolution.
What about politics? Where do Black people fit into the political spectrum right now? Or should they at all?
Well, politics is defined by the geographical and influential spheres of this country. It's irrelevant to Black people and irrelevant to the masses of people. The vote has been used as a tool of oppression against Black people. I mean, Camus raises a very good point when he says, what better way to enslave a man than give him the vote and call him free? See, it does not profit Black people or poor people anything to have the vote and not be able to select the candidates who they want to choose. Now, how can you choose between Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Agnew, Wallace, and Humphrey? There is no choice. Evil is evil. There's nothing in between that.
There was some lesser candidates, Dick Gregory running for office, Eldridge Cleaver.
I think the vote can only be used as a tool of organization. We can only use the vote to organize our people. Now, to really believe that we can put someone in office and that these people would be responsive to our needs, it's naive. Because even if one of the Black candidates who ran for office was to take the office of president, then Black people must be prepared to fight against that person.
Why?
Because, you see, the system mandates the action of the individual. The individual does not determine how this country will function. This country works off the military-industrial complex, which means that it's profitable to wage war. And unless you, you know, devise another plan, another scheme to sustain, to boost this economy, then it's going to be necessary to wage war, whether, you know, a Black individual is in office or a white individual is in office. Well, so we're talking about a complete change in system.
If Mr. Cleaver did win the election, don't you think that he could have conducted the presidency in a unique manner that may not be, you know, compromising to the system you speak of?
No, because, you, as I said, the system dictates the response of individuals. You see, individuals do not influence politically, economically, or socially.
Individuals do not create rebellions. Conditions do. On August 31st, 1967, several thousand delegates gathered at the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago for the opening rally of the National Conference for New Politics, NCNP Convention. This event was an ambitious attempt to develop a broad coalition of over 200 different organizations that included the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Students for a Democratic Society, the Socialist Workers' Party, and the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. According to Kundandani in The New Malcolm X, who was Jamil Alameen, the forgotten radical of the civil rights movement, on the opening night, Dr. King outlined an anti-capitalist politics that had become essential to his worldview. This, of course, has been erased from dominant discourses on Dr. King. For King, capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. The only solution, according to Dr. King, was a radical redistribution of political and economic power. Another key point to highlight was that there was talk at the convention of running King as an independent candidate of the left in the following year's presidential election. Despite the prominent role of King in SCLC, the leading black organization at the NCNP convention was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee chaired by Jamil Alameen, then known as H. Rapp Brown. Born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Alameen worked with the civil rights movement in Alabama and Mississippi in the mid-1960s. He was only 23 years old when he was elected SNCC's national chair, 4 months before the NCNP convention. As he traveled the U.S. that summer, federal agents and informants constantly tailed him. In the month and a half before arriving in Chicago, he had been shot in the face with buckshot by a deputy sheriff and arrested twice on incitement to arson and riot in Maryland. A state attorney later admitted to fabricating the charges. And on firearms charges in Louisiana, these were voided on appeal when it emerged that the judge had announced at the state's Bar Association convention before the trial that, quote, "I'm going to get that N-word." A few days before the NCNP convention, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sent a memo to all of the Bureau's field offices instructing them to establish new secret, quote, counterintelligence endeavors to, quote, expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activities of black nationalist-type organizations and groupings. This did not exclude King's SCLC, and Jamil Alameen was one of four, quote, extremists mentioned by name in the memo. Over the next 3 months, the FBI sent to the White House an average of two memos a week describing Alameen's activities. Due to his innate ability to be very clear on identifying the objectives and mapping and presenting viable means to achieve these objectives, many begin to see Jamil Alameen, then H. Rapp Brown, in the tradition of Malcolm X. At a speech to the NCNP Convention's Black Caucus, Alameen drew a grim picture of the situation facing Black America. Alameen argued that, quote, "America is putting into effect the genocide of Black people," and suggested that this was happening in four ways. First, Black people made up 1 in 3 of the U.S. deaths in the war in Vietnam, though they represented only 1 in 10 of the U.S. population. Two, huge numbers of Black children in the Deep South are dying each year of poverty. Three, Black people were being sent to prisons in the name of law and order. And four, Black folk were being disproportionately targeted in the area of reproductive health. Alameen rejected the liberal narrative that the U.S. was on the verge of overcoming past legacies of racism. The racial advances that liberals celebrated in the 1960s were superficial, he argued. In fact, there was regress, not progress. The only way to stop this impending violence was by force. Jamil Alameen further argued that, quote, "violence against Black people perpetuated by both political parties and enabled by the repressive powers granted to the national security agencies was escalating because of economic changes. Quote, we were brought here as enslaved peoples to work. There is no more work. We are a problem to America. Now, the U.S. has, quote, a surplus of N-words. We have outlived our usefulness." In an interview a few weeks earlier, he told a French journalist that, quote, "the capitalistic system as it is set up cannot accommodate 40 or 50 million Black folk. We believe that this structure cannot be reformed." For H. Rapp Brown, quote, "racism in the United States was a system of carceral, economic, police, and military violence tied at this historical moment to a coming contradiction of capitalism's need for Black waged labor. To be deemed surplus to capitalism was, he suggested, to be vulnerable to mass incarceration or, quote, elimination. For Jamil Alamin, as he told the NCNP's Black Caucus in Chicago, it is essential to connect with other oppressed groups across the world in Puerto Rico, Vietnam, Africa, and Latin America. Quote, we are a colony inside of America. Black people constitute a colony, an internal colony, he argued. Alamin's predecessor to SNCC's chair, Kwame Ture, then known as Stokely Carmichael, wrote that the slogan of Black Power, which SNCC had adopted that previous year, meant, quote, that Black people see themselves as part of a new force, sometimes called the Third World. Some scholars, such as the historian Matthew Jacobson, described the NCNP convention as the moment when, quote, identity politics was born. Nevertheless, it is without question that this conceptualization distorts Jamil Alamin's and other Black radical thinkers at the time idea of identity. Jamil Alamin wrote that it was necessary for Black people to begin to define your Black heritage in order to overcome the self-hatred inculcated by white superiority. But the definition of identity was the first stage in a process that had to go beyond cultural heritage to a radical politic. For Alamin, quote, we must move from Black awareness to revolutionary motion. The recognition or celebration of Black cultural identity is not necessarily anti-revolutionary. When you begin to stress culture without politics, people could become so hooked up on the beauty of themselves that they have no desire to fight. It becomes ego-gratifying just to be Black, end quote. The evolution of H. Rock Brown into Jamil Alamin provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black freedom movement in more ways than we can account for. Today, we present a recent conversation with Arun Kundindani where we explore the political praxis of Jamil Alamin. Arun Kundindani is a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. Born in London, he moved to New York in 2010 and now lives in Philadelphia. Kundindani is the author of What is Anti-Racism, published by Verso Books in 2023, The Muslims Are Coming, also published by Verso Books, and The End of Tolerance, published by Pluto Press, 2007. He has written for The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, Vice, and The Intercept, to name a few outlets. Educated at Cambridge University, he holds a PhD from London Metropolitan University. He has been a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and a former editor of Race and Class, the quarterly journal of the Institute of Race Relations in London. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. Thank you for taking the time to join us today to have a very robust but wide-ranging conversation about some work that you're doing, specifically on one of our important political, social, cultural thinkers who is still with us.
Thanks for having me, James.
So let's dive right into the conversation, because what I want to do is really build an intellectual biography over, formerly known as H. Rock Brown. Let's talk a little bit about the work. How did you come to this particular project?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer to the question is about 10 years ago, I wrote a book called The Muslims Are Coming, which was about the experiences of Muslims in the United States in the kind of war on terror period when, you know, they were experiencing a lot of targeting by the federal government and law enforcement agencies and so on. And it was about the what that looked like and the experiences that they were going through. And one of the stories I looked at was the case of someone called Luqman Abdullah, who was an imam, a Black Muslim in Detroit, who the FBI in the early 2000s like wrongly suspected of being some kind of Islamic extremist, Al-Qaeda type of person. And they did their usual thing of putting, you know, informants into his organization and so on. It's kind of, long story short, culminated in an FBI raid in which FBI agents shot and killed him in October 2009. And so I spent you know, a good bit of time kind of investigating that story and writing about that for that book. And one of the strands to it that I didn't follow up at the time, but which I became aware of, was that the reason that the FBI originally targeted this guy was because he was part of an organization led by Imam Jamil Al-Amin. And I was aware that Jamil Al-Amin was formerly known as H.R.A.P. Brown, and I was aware that H.R.A.P. Brown was Black. At that time, I wouldn't have been able to tell you anything more about him. And so then after that book came out, I thought, let me follow up on this strand. It might be quite interesting. And I went to Atlanta and met with Karima Al-Amin, who is his wife, going back to 1968. And I spent a few hours chatting with her, and it just became apparent that this is a remarkable thing, that this man, currently in a federal prison, incarcerated since 2000, as won't be surprising, on charges that don't really stand up when you look at them carefully, is not only like a significant figure in terms of the history of Muslims in the United States, and was effectively, you know, one of the most important Muslim leaders during the 1990s in the US. And so has this kind of element that's about how Muslims have been criminalized and the war on terror and so on. But then also goes back to the Black Power movement of the late 60s, early 70s. And Ben was a household name, you know, would have been on television, would have been one of the most prominent voices articulating that kind of revolutionary politics and experiencing the resulting repression as well. One of the four people named in the famous COINTELPRO memo that the FBI sent out in August 1967 as you know, one of the kind of radicals that they were most concerned about. And so it seemed to me that through this one person's story, you could connect together these different aspects of the, you know, the kind of history of the US going back to the 60s and through the 90s and into the war on terror. Unlike, you know, that if you think about the comparable figures from that period of the late 60s, early 70s, you know, obviously many of them were killed. Many of them were exiled. You know, Kwame Ture ends up spending the rest of his life in Africa. Many are, you know, in one way or another go wayward or become semi-respectable, you know, perhaps with jobs in academia or whatever. But he's one of the only ones that is still basically operating at street level, doing community organizing with a new framework, and kind of the Islamic framework that he applies is different from the Black Power framework, although it has some overlaps. But he's still doing that kind of work that he was trying to do from the 60s onwards. And that seemed unusual and remarkable. And you know, because he's in prison, that whole history has been erased, right? And his name's been more or less forgotten. All the kind of attention to the Black Power movement that we've seen recently, he doesn't really get mentioned in that. So it seemed that perhaps it would be, you know, I was amazed that no one's written a biography of him. No one was working on a biography of him. And I thought, okay, maybe I should give it a go and hope.
Oh, I wanted to pull in a strand here, because a strand of thought here. And I think I meant to say Jamil earlier, but, you know, the central figure, of course, we're talking about is Jamil Al-Amin, but also he represents a long tradition of resistance that stretches back, you know, specifically, you know, in the context of a Islam and Muslim resistance that stretches back a long historical era of resistance, particularly when we talk about, you know, the enslavement process, people kind of focus on the West African, but, you know, there was a North African and an East African. And of course, there was uprisings that was happening specifically in that particular region. So there's a long history here. Could you talk a little bit, the person that we're talking about that's embodying this resistance, this long tradition of resistance, but using this framework and the evolution, because we see Malcolm X do the, you know, kind of, you know, the same thing. So we see this tradition of Islam being a very, very important framework that kind of sharpens a particular period. So let's talk a little bit about as much resistance to enslavement, roots and resistance in that particular context, and we'll move forward.
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's often forgotten that a good portion of the Africans who were enslaved and brought across the Atlantic were Muslims. And obviously, you know, Islam was prominent in West Africa and across the rest of Africa. So there was certainly efforts in the plantation system to kind of erase that that cultural import from Africa, right? And in various ways, like resistance to that attempt to erase, right? So, and for example, in Brazil, there is evidence of slave rebellions that are not only involving Muslims, but actually organized through a kind of Islamic framework. Right? So Islam becomes a means of a kind of ideology of resistance, at least in the Brazilian context, right? But that kind of Islamic force in among African Americans is kind of its hidden presence through the centuries until you get to the beginning of the 20th century, when you get various movements in Black communities that kind of embrace Islam. And I mean, there's a huge tapestry there of different elements to explore. Obviously, the notion of Islam is one part of that. But in fact, I mean, I think the majority of Muslims in the United States, you know, through the 20th century into the present day, the majority haven't actually been Nation of Islam followers, but various other kinds of strands to that that tapestry. And in relation to Jameel Al-Amin, the relevant part of this is a group called the Darul Islam, who emerged in Brooklyn through the 50s and 60s. And part of what's going on there is the circulation of preachers who've actually come from either South Asia or the Middle East in the, you know, New York City of the mid-20th century. And Black people finding something in the kind of religious and always implicitly, if not explicitly, political message that's circulating there. And then eventually appropriating that message to create their own Black Muslim congregations, imams, organizations, and so on. So that by the time H.R.A.P. Brown finds himself in the New York State prison system in 1971, and is looking at, you know, for the first time in his life, a relatively long stretch of imprisonment. He is engaging with people who are already in prison, who are active with the Darul Islam, and he's persuaded to embrace Islam, after he's out of prison in 1976, goes to Atlanta, settles down there, and becomes an imam and builds a community within this Darul Islam movement. The Darul Islam is about, it's closer to the way Islam would be understood in the rest of the world compared to, say, the Nation of Islam. It's, in that sense, it's less heterodox. It's essentially the argument that the participants are making at the time in this point in the 1970s is the kind of Black Revolution of the 1960s has ended up not achieving its kind of most revolutionary goals because it lacks a kind of spiritual core, and that's what Islam offers, right? And the idea would be that if you look around at the situation in the early 70s that Rap Brown is seeing, he's seeing, you know, members of his own organization being recruited as informants. He's seeing a kind of failure of loyalty, essentially, right? And he puts that down to the absence of his spiritual core, so that men can be co-opted by offers of money or offers of alleviation of various kinds by the system. And so he talks about, you know, what Islam does is it makes you COINTELPRO-proof, right? It gives you this kind of inner strength that means that you can't be co-opted in that way that things like COINTELPRO try to do. At the same time, its idea of what the revolution is going to look like, I think, is a much kind of longer term kind of picture, because it says that there's not only the external enemy of white supremacy or racial capitalism or imperialism, whatever it is, but there's also the internal enemy, right, of the ways that made you individualistic or about your own history and identity and ancestry, or making you not be able to create a kind of true kind of unified community with others, right? And so it's a need to work on that, on those kind of internal questions. Often the people that are being drawn into this are people who are struggling with things like addiction or have suffered various harms in their lives that have shaped their psychology in those kinds of ways. And so Islam, I think that's what a lot of people are finding in Islam at this point, when so many Black Power activists turn to it in the early 70s, is this kind of way that it speaks to the inner core of who you are, as well as describing how you have these external enemies, within the system itself.
You made me think specifically about the relationship between Black classical music, what some people call jazz, and a lot of the artists who are also at the same time, creating art simultaneously with Black liberation or the Black liberation movement, but also are dealing with addiction and dealing with these, these categories. In the 1970s, when we're talking about the Black liberation movement, is very important. And we're going to tease this out. But before we tease out the fracturing that's happening and the need for some type of system or institution to kind of hold accountability, a personal accountability to the collective aims and objectives of a Black liberation movement. Before we get to that fracturing, because you touched on it there and I want to tease that out, let's go back to the experiences of SNCC, because when we talk about SNCC, most people don't even have any clue or idea about the dominant discourse of the relationship between, of course, at the time, H.R.I. Brown and SNCC, and then the evolution, because I think that is important in formulating and making sure that Jamil is making sure he's in community at the grassroots level. I think that was a very important. So to talk about, the move into SNCC, how did that develop and those influences, and then we'll go back to that 1970 period as well.
I mean, when people talk about the history of SNCC, they usually stop, most of the time people stop at about 1966. At best, they get to 1967. Rap Brown becomes chair of SNCC in May 1967. He's come up in the organization through his older brother, Ed Brown, who's been active with it a little longer. By 1966, Rap is running the Alabama project for SNCC. And, the work that he's doing there, people call it voting rights, but that doesn't really capture what it really looks like on the ground. What it really looks like on the ground is more like a kind of guerrilla warfare, right? Because the aim is to use the fact that in black majorities, but the counties are run by a white minority, and so the idea is to register people to vote and then use those votes to get SNCC's black people elected to positions of political power, so that then you can start to lift people out of the extreme poverty they're experiencing. I mean, it's literally people living in shacks and in kind of third world conditions, right? And so that's the aim now. But when you go about doing that, essentially, the white power structure deploys extreme violence to try and stop you. And so what's going on is folks like Rap are essentially arming themselves in order to have some capacity to get people, to register to vote and then to be able to stand candidates in elections. So that's what that work looks like. In May 1967, he's elected the chair of SNCC, after Soapy Carmichael. In the standard history, this is the sort of moment of supposedly the moment of decline of SNCC, when the kind of older kind of glory days are over. And instead of, in the sort of standard history, you had this kind of earlier period of SNCC of kind of black and white uniting around a shared kind of democratic agenda of kind of community organizing. And now, you know, from 67 or so, it's kind of descending into kind of ideological posturing without any real community base and so on. That's a standard story. Actually, you know, what's going on is really as soon as Rap Brown becomes chair of SNCC, and, you know, and the program is a community building program around the whole country instead of where they've been concentrated before in the South. And the kind of issues they're talking about are, mobilizing around the draft, right? And kind of SNCC at this point is kind of the main organization that's actively trying to prevent the draft for the Vietnam War and focusing on you know, essentially black teenagers who have been drafted in massively disproportionate numbers. It's about organizing with black women around welfare rights and so on, right? So this is the agenda that they're developing. But what you get in the summer of 67 is this huge series of uprisings that spread across the United States. And that kind of changed everything because, you can kind of read the memos coming out of the White House and out of Hoover heading this idea that we need someone to blame. We need to kind of identify the agitator that's responsible for all these uprisings, because if we don't have that, then we have to confront the fact that these uprisings are the product of the desperate conditions that people are living in, and therefore, you know, the blame falls to the broader society. So they essentially, you know, Stokely Carmichael's out of the country for most of that summer. Rap Brown is around, and he's traveling around Black America, and so they basically pin the blame on him, begin this whole kind of legal process of pinning charges on him that essentially time down in court battles with judges putting out orders to confine him to the Southern District of New York. So essentially he can't really leave Manhattan anymore. So his whole plan to kind of travel around the US doing this organizing work is shut down. And he's tied up in the courts for the next few years. All those charges end up being thrown out, you know, like 4 or 5 years later on appeal. But it essentially paralyzes his organizing for that period. But he becomes a household name because he's, he's on TV and he's speaking at meetings at different places, becomes this incredibly powerful voice, especially for young people, you know, the black teenagers who see him as representing their experience more offensively than anyone else. And so, you know, I think over the next few years, he's kind of potential, you know, people are talking about him as, oh, he could be the next Malcolm X. He could be this huge figure, but the potential is never realized because of the various systems of oppression that are deployed against him.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation with African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope with Aaron Kundanani, a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. And this conversation, in the context of Black August, explores the political praxis of Jamil Alameen, the evolution of H. Rap Brown into Jamil Alameen. Provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black freedom movement in more ways than we can account for. The music in the background is Talking About a Revolution by Tracy Chapman. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
And I wanted to, you know, find the continuity because we're talking about 1966, 1967, and of course, 1968. And these are very, very, you know, crucial periods, particularly for, you know, Black community organizing, whether it's SNCC or other other organized formations around the nation. And of course, you know, the draft, you know, Vietnam and all that, Palestine becomes obviously an issue. And so there's an internationalist turn or I shouldn't say a turn, but a reintroduction of an international perspective that a lot of, at the time, H. Rod Brown, Jamil Alameen, and others are kind of formulating an ideological frame of reference to understand. Could you talk a little bit about that particular influence as well? Because that becomes very essential, I think, as we're moving to this 1970s period.
Yeah, absolutely. So the position that SNCC is taking, SNCC kind of put out the idea of black power, right? And then there's this debate about what does black power mean, right? But what it means to Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown, who are the two kind of leading voices articulating it at the time.
And Mukasa Dada as well. Mukasa Dada, Willie
Ricks. Willie Ricks is the guy who, in this kind of famous meeting in Mississippi, is the first person to kind of put that slogan out there in meetings, and then Stokely takes it up later. That's right. It's worth adding his name into the story. But the meaning of it is essentially, my interpretation of all the materials from them that I've read, my interpretation would be, what they're essentially saying is that there's already a kind of revolution taking place in what would have been called the Third World, right? In particular in Africa, Africa, these are young people, right? They're in their early 20s. In their teenage years, they've seen this thing that's never happened in living memory, right? Of Africans successfully defeating a white power structure called European colonialism, right? And then the leaders of those revolutionary movements, appearing on television at the United Nations as representatives of their nations, of their continent, right? That's huge. I mean, that's unprecedented. It's a completely different thing from, seeing Obama be the president or Nelson Mandela in South Africa, and saying, oh, these were mentors, these are kind of figures that kind of show that if you work hard, you can kind of achieve things. It's a completely different proposition that we're talking about for that generation, because it's about not just that these are inspirational figures, but these are people who've led a revolution. And therefore, if there can be a revolution that overthrows a white power structure in Africa, why can't there be a revolution that overthrows a white power structure in Newark or Detroit or Alabama, right? Which are also places where black majorities are governed by white minorities, right? That's what black power is importing that possibility and that kind of set of revolutionary methods that people are believing that they can discover in the African anti-colonial movements, importing those into the United States. Malcolm X talks about the need for a Mau Mau in the US, right? That's the idea, right? And so what that means then as well is this internationalist sense, because there's an understanding that people all around the world are involved in these kind of anti-imperialist struggles, right? Whether it's the people in Vietnam, whether it's the people in Puerto Rico, whether it's the people in Latin America, right? And Palestine. So, when you get in the summer of 67, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights, Israeli forces, Rap Brown is the first to say that, look, that struggle, all the other struggles against colonialism, right? And essentially saying Zionism is a form of colonialism that needs to be opposed, just like black people in the United States are opposing the internal colonialism they experience, right? So that's, SNCC is, it's not the black power stand from a year or two before then that loses all the money for SNCC and all their funding, nor is it the stand against the Vietnam War from a couple of years before then that leads to them losing all their funding. In fact, it's the very next day after they put out their Palestine statement that they get the calls, from the landlords and so on, saying, sorry, we're going to have to evict you from your office. Sorry, these donations are going to now stop, right? And in ways that feel very, very contemporary, you know, for what we're living with right now. So, but they, you know, they were standing on a matter of internationalist anti-imperialist solidarity, right? And so that was the principle. Rap Brown spent a lot of time organizing with the Puerto Rican movements in the in New York City that were burgeoning and that later become the Young Lords organization. You know, working very closely with people like Felipe Luciano, who was one of the founders of the Young Lords. He worked very closely with the movements that are springing up in the southwest of the United States around the Chicano struggle. Worked closely with the American Indians. It was a sense that, you know, these organizations and these movements are all involved in a shared struggle, right? And to you know, it gives a remarkable speech in the summer of 67, where he says, you know, we think we're called a minority in the United States. But if you think on the world scale, we're not a minority because we're everywhere, you know, is one of the lines from that speech, right? The Vietnamese are black. And what he means is in the end, black is not just about, you know, a skin history. In the end, it's about a political position in a global. And so anyone who's engaged in fighting against Western imperialism, the white power structure, and so on and so on, is part of this shared movement, this shared struggle.
And I wanted to, you know, just stay here just for a quick second, particularly this 1966, 67, 68, again, leading to this internationalist term, because again, Jamil is in the context of Kwame Ture or Soka Carmichael becoming Kwame Ture, because again, he leaves, goes to the Dialectics of Liberation Conference in London. So there's an internet. So there is a evolution that is happening very rapidly where we can't forget to put in Cuba in this, Robert F. Williams' influence on a lot of the activists. And so they're looking at successful revolutions, right? On the dictate of Malcolm, of our best teachers, history becomes the best teacher. So there's all these continuities that are happening here that I think is important for us to understand, even though we're talking about a figure, but a figure not separated from the continuities and the contextualization of young people looking at the world, looking at their present, you know, their material conditions within which, and trying to find continuity in that. So this notion is, so this ideological development is very clear, I would say. Could you talk a little bit more about, you know, the evolution of again, at the time, H. Rock Brown, as he's developing this understanding, using black as a term for of oppression that, you know, Palestinians I think is important, because again, once we get to this 1970s, there's these shifts that's happening, right, in a global context, but also heavy reverberations that are happening. And I'm using H. Rock Brown and Jamil interchangeably, but you know, again, we're talking at a particular navigating this, but at the same time facing repression from the tease that out just a little bit more. Are you just jump yeah. in, respond?
Yeah, yeah, I don't
even know if there's a question.
Well, let me say this. Yeah. Firstly, like, you know, just thinking about those references, right? What are people thinking about in terms of different revolutionary movements around the world? What are they reading? One of the kind of nice things that you can do in the archives here, when you get you know, you put in your FBI freedom of information requests and get all these surveillance materials from the FBI. And so I've got probably like 100,000 pages of his stuff from all his life. So it's a sort of funny resource to use to try and understand someone's life. But one of the things you get is what are his possessions each time he's arrested? What are his possessions that he has on him, right? And usually there's some books there that he's got on him. I don't know if a lot of the time, he's arrested, you know, in a situation where he knows he's about to be arrested and he's going to be spending some time behind bars. So maybe he's got some books on him. to occupy while he's you know in jail. But you can see what he's reading, right? So what do you see? You know, he's reading Nkrumah, he's reading Fanon, he's reading Robert Williams. You know, the picture you get of the worldview that he's developing is this concept of third world revolution that you would associate with those kinds of riots. So that's absolutely there. In terms of, you know, so someone like Stokely, Kwame Ture, you know, he's much more of a person who wants to travel around the world and kind of, you know, meet with the Cuban leadership, meet with the leadership in Ghana or in you know in Guinea and so on, and you know appear on these platforms in London. That's not really Rap Brown's personality, right? He's not kind of dazzled by that so much. And so while he's absorbing all these, you know, information about what's happening in other parts of the world, he's very focused on black communities in the US as where he wants to be based and where he wants to be operating, right? And you know, so he in 1970, you know, when he's about to be put on trial on a charge of incitement to arson in Cambridge, Maryland, a charge that collapses, you know, further down the road on appeal. But he's supposed to be turning up in the court there in Maryland on those charges. And two of his close associates who are driving a car not far from the town where the trial is going to be happening are blown up in a car bomb. And the circumstances of that remain unknown, essentially. Like, we don't essentially know what happened there. But that is a moment that Rap Brown interprets as, okay, I'm not going to be turning up this trial when there's bombs going on. And so there's this period of 18 months or so where essentially he's underground, as so many others were at that time, you know, particularly draft evaders. He doesn't describe it as underground. He says that he just didn't want to turn up to the court, you know, the court. But like, he was put on the FBI's most wanted list. They added an 11th place to the 10 most wanted list just for him. And he spends 18 months essentially, you know, the government's trying to track him down, and they're not able to. During that time, he briefly goes to Africa for a little while. He spends some time in Egypt and in Tanzania, in Cairo. And then he meets with all the Southern African liberation movements in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and you know, and both those cities obviously have remarkably interesting radical politics going on at the time. But that's not really for him, right? What he's off back into the US again, and what he thinks is the crucial issue affecting black communities at that time is the question of heroin, right? And heroin, essentially, you know, what he's figuring out is that there's a massive increase in heroin in you know, in that moment in the late 60s, arriving in the US essentially as blowback from the war in Vietnam, where the CIA has been essentially operating with, engaging with the heroin business as a way to get cash to carry out covert operations. You know, whenever you have that, you know, kind of CIA covert operations, there's usually some kind of relationship with the narcotics business for various reasons, and you get these kind of effects, right? So, Harlem is a completely different place after a couple of years of this, you know, with the effects of heroin. Rap is essentially adopting this strategy with a wider crew of going after the drug dealers. He understands that the Italian mafia are bringing heroin in. he understands that the government and the NYPD and so on are very happy for that to be happening because it essentially pacifies the community in this moment when there's a revolutionary upsurge.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Aaron Kundanani, a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. The conversation in the context of Black August, as we commemorate Black August this month, with African Hour's executive producer and co-host James Pope, explores the political praxis of Jamil Alamin. The evolution of H. Rap Brown into Jamil Alamin provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black freedom movement in more ways than we can account for. Aaron Kundanani is author of What is Anti-Racism? The Muslims Are Coming and The End of Tolerance. He has written for The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, Vice, and Intercept, to name a few outlets. Aaron Kundanani has been a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and a former editor of the journal Race and Class, the quarterly journal of the Institute of Race Relations in London. He was educated at Cambridge University and he holds a PhD from the London Metropolitan University. He'll be on African Now's SoundCloud page, and that's at African Now Online on SoundCloud. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Free by Ertu Morira, and that's commemorating his birthday, which was on August 5th. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Mtali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly the plight of Palestinians in Gaza and beyond, which is followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Akichi Taifa, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda. And our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, particularly next week during our summer pledge drive. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Skokiyan by Louis Armstrong, commemorating his birthday, which was on August 4th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Squad House Representative Cori Bush was defeated in an expensive primary battle last night, losing with 46% of the vote to St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Wesley Bell. Bush's criticism of Israel's war in Gaza featured prominently in the race, and a super PAC backed by the pro-Israel AIPAC spent $8.5 million to oust her. That same super PAC spent $15 million in June to defeat another squad member, New York's Jamal Bowman, who lost to pro-Israel centrist George Latimer. In her concession speech last night, Bush decried the amount of money spent to defeat her.
This was the second most expensive congressional race in our nation's history. $19 million and counting. And so that's how much they spent in this race. Mostly far-right funded super PACs against the interests of the people of St. Louis, the people of Missouri's first. They sought to divide us.
Wesley Bell is expected to easily carry Missouri's first congressional district in the November general election. In a statement, he promised to serve, quote, the St. Louis region and Congress with integrity, transparency, and dedication, end quote. Tropical Storm Debbie is back over the Atlantic, where it is regaining strength and lashing the coast of the southeast United States. The storm is expected to make a second landfall tomorrow on the South Carolina coast, and is forecast to dump historic amounts of rain and bring life-threatening flooding along its path over the next few days. Debbie has already unleashed relentless rain across the southeast. At least 6 fatalities have been reported in Florida and Georgia since the storm initially hit Florida's Gulf Coast as a Category 1 hurricane. Coastal governors have declared states of emergency as neighborhoods find themselves submerged due to widespread flooding. Global warming, caused by fossil fuel pollution, is causing storms to get wetter and strengthen more quickly. Debbie is forecast to move through the mid-Atlantic by the end of the week. A federal appeals court yesterday upheld Maryland's ban on military-style firearms, saying the weapons covered in the law are not subject to Second Amendment protections. The court endorsed the ban, saying, quote, our nation has a strong tradition of regulating excessively dangerous weapons, an inordinate toll on public safety and societal well-being, end quote. Maryland passed the gun control measure after the Sandy Hook mass shooting in 2012, when an AR-15 was used to kill 20 children and 6 adults at a Connecticut elementary school. The law bans dozens of firearms, including the AR-15 and the AK-47, and puts a 10-round limit on gun magazines. The Second Amendment Foundation is promising to appeal yesterday's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. The document falsely claiming that former President Trump won the 2020 presidential election in Arizona has pleaded guilty, marking the first conviction in the state's case against so-called fake electors. According to court filings, Lorraine Pellegrino pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge of filing a false document and was sentenced to unsupervised probation. She previously faced 9 felony counts. The guilty plea comes the same week that charges were dismissed against ex-Trump attorney Jenna Ellis, another defendant in that case, after she reached a cooperation agreement with law enforcement. Trump himself was not charged in the Arizona case, but he was identified by a state grand jury as an unindicted co-conspirator. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 86 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 65 degrees with light rain. For WPFW in Washington and WBA.